try to write something and say to yourself, listen, when this hits the world, I want people to unsubscribe or forward it to somebody else. I'm willing to take that risk that when they read this, it's going to force one of two things. Now, all of a sudden, they're more interested in what you're writing because you're being more human, you're being more thoughtful.
Welcome. This is Unfolding, the show where I unfold creative business minds. My name is Marco Pfann, and now I just want you to sit back and enjoy the show. Today we are talking to David C. Baker, the author of many books, two which I really admire. One is The Business of Expertise, which you should read. And the second one, which recently came out, I think as recent as last year, is Secret Tradecraft of Elite Advisors. Highly recommend them. And the reason, David, why I want to talk to you today is because in one of your latest newsletters, you talked about the scarcity mindset. And the scarcity mindset is something that I have to deal with my clients. Well, I have to address a lot with my clients. And I love that you picked up the topic, and I would love to dive into that.
Sure.
That'd be cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, I certainly didn't invent the concept. I picked up the phrase from somebody, and I'm sure the idea has been around for many, many years. But it seems to me like the industry that I serve is really unique in the sense that they're really good people who care a lot about the work and so on. And in some cases, they can be very collaborative with their peers, but they suffer from this really severe scarcity mindset, not believing that there's sort of, it's sort of, I guess, the easy way to think about it is a scarcity mindset is a belief that there's a certain pie and you have to get your part and it's not unlimited, right? And I've never operated that way, and a lot of my clients follow my thinking on that, and then most of them probably don't. So that's what prompted the article.
I like the analogy or the metaphor of that cake, that there's not enough. So in your email, you describe a lot of those situations, like when people come to this, like how people express that scarcity mindset. And if I'm correct, it's something like, what was that? Like entitlement of the team, the clients not paying enough. Basically, all those problems people see these days. Mm-hmm. How can we get people out of that scarcity mindset?
Yeah, I wish I had an easy answer for that, because I'd probably just wave that magic wand and get people out of it. I have seen people migrate from a scarcity mindset to more of an abundance mindset, but it takes something much deeper than some external advisor telling them that they aren't thinking accurately. It seems like it's something that they bring to the table. It's a certain perspective that is probably much bigger than how they run their business. It's probably a part of their life as well. Sort of seeing, you see a glass and you see it half empty. That's how they're seeing it. And then they, sometimes it kind of wanders into conspiracy theory, not an actual conspiracy, but they feel like they're a victim, that there's hardly anything they can do. They find other people that they can commiserate with instead. And so what happens is they go into each situation, whether it's a client or an employee, team member, or maybe it's a procurement officer or a sales situation or whatever it is, they go into it just assuming that it won't change. And then they just accept that reality and wallow around in it. And it just isn't all that helpful. But, I think it's so pervasive that it's pretty easy to see that in somebody the first minute you meet them because of how they talk about things, right? There isn't this unbounded enthusiasm. And I think, denying reality in the opposite direction is just as bad, like not acknowledging some of the difficulties. I think, like, I'm not an optimist, and a lot of people on the other side of this argument would be optimists. I'm not an optimist in that sense. I'm more of a hopeful person, which means I'm trying to look at a situation and honestly acknowledge the difficulty of it, but not accept that, but just do what I can do.
So you go into the situation, you know the limitations, but you hope for a better outcome and you fight for it. You take your chance, right?
Yeah, right. Because after a while, when you listen to somebody that has a scarcity mentality, you know, it's like, oh, I can't find good clients nowadays, or man, these employees feel so entitled and feel like the tax burden in my state, it just keeps getting heavier and heavier. And at some point you just want to say, hey, shut up and go do something else. It's like, that's fine. Oh, like, yeah, you know,
just pick another job. That's so true. And what I love what you just said is like that people actually identify with that kind of victim persona and don't even try to change things anymore. Yeah. That's a great insight. That's amazing.
They just give up and
they give up. Mm-hmm.
That's not the person I am. You know, I feel like, and I think that my clients who are in the creative space, I think they should feel the same way that I do on this point. It's like, okay, I'm a consultant, an author, and if this doesn't work out, who cares? It's like, this is one of 20 things I could have done, and I've really enjoyed this run, but I do believe certain things, and I'm not going to compromise on those, even if it means I need to go find something else to do. But these people feel, when you hear them talk, they feel like they're trapped, like they don't have choices. And like, if we could weave sort of an economics term in here, it's called agency, where individuals have the freedom to choose. It doesn't mean that all the options in front of them are great, but they do have the freedom to choose. They are not victims of what's happening. They are recipients of what's happening, but they're not victims of it. And so it's just like, you have agency. And every time you blame somebody else for the status of your firm, then nothing is happening. And it might be true that your firm is in a certain place because of some of these external factors. But if you're not responsible for the work environment, for the profit, for your new business plan, then please tell me who is. It's like, if it isn't you, we can't blame other people about this. You are responsible. Mm-hmm. Your thumbprint is all over your firm. Take responsibility for it. Try to fix it. It's never going to be perfect, but don't just keep looking for reasons why the industry is like, AI is hitting us right now, right? I saw Sam Altman said a week or two ago, 95% of firms could easily be replaced by AI in the very near future. And so you have people, they're all AI experts, it seems like, saying our entire worlds are going to change. It's like, no, they are not going to change entirely. It's going to be an adjustment. We'll figure out what to do. There's still going to be an industry. That's just bullshit. It's like, I've been around long enough to see all these projections. It's like, oh no, now it's Adobe. Everybody can be a designer. And another half dozen of them. No, sorry. It's like, is that the depth of your confidence in your abilities that some stupid, lame AI thing is going to take your job? It's like, no, sorry. It's not true.
That's a good point. Like, a lot of creatives, they have insane confidence when it comes to the skill set and the tools they use, but not really in articulating the expertise or the craft or even the strategies they intuitively build into their products and their assets. That's so true. And yeah, if you don't, like, you actually get into I can get that. I get that, that people move into a scarcity mindset when you take away the one thing they believe they're good at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think probably we're somewhat victims of how the greater culture views what we do. It's like we're part of the professional services, right? But there's no certification. There's no training requirement. Mm-hmm. And so unwittingly, we kind of are like excited because we can just hang a shingle out and start a firm. But I think subconsciously we realize, oh, anybody can do that, right?
So yeah, who am I? Yeah. So yeah, how can I prove that I'm good? And the way we prove it is with the work. That's why we so heavily rely on doing great work. So what I understand is that you have hope for the industry. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the industry really ought to get its act together, but I have never felt better about the industry than I do now. Yeah, and I think the idea that AI is going to knock us off the perch is a ridiculous idea that's usually being spread by people who are selling AI consulting kind of stuff, right? And it's just like, come on, people, like, get a grip. This isn't that big a deal. It's something we'll have to adapt to, and the smartest firms will incorporate AI. But if you think AI is going to take you out of business, then you're not very good at what you do.
I'm old enough that I experienced the transition from analog video to digital video. Mm. And it was kind of a similar like mindset back then. People were worried that they don't have jobs anymore because you don't need the fancy equipment anymore, the expensive stuff. And what happened in reality was that there was like the jobs just doubled, tripled, quadrupled. Like there's so many more jobs out there for creatives these days than it used to be like 20 years ago mm-hmm. when that transition occurred. So I just wanted to share the story because I too think there's hope for the industry, but yeah, we don't know where this whole thing is going. So you have hope for the industry, and what do you think is the future of like the near future of the creative industry?
Mm-hmm. I think it's fantastic. There's going to be this continued phasing out of the firms that are charging clients to do things and a brighter spotlight on the firms that help clients with the complexity. Because one of the promises of the digital age was that we would solve the attribution problem. We would know what worked. We could then pour more gasoline on that fire. And so on. And that hasn't been the case at all. What has happened is that we have way more levers to move the needle, and we are still never quite sure exactly what's working. And so the spoils in this fight are going to go to the firms that can solve the complexity issue, not the attribution issue. And I think the industry is very bright for those people who really study, who have data-driven methodologies, who have a unique positioning so that they can dive really deep, because the patterns are harder to notice than they used to be because of that complexity. And so the days of the generalist firm are going to continue to erode as they have over the last 25 years, and I think that's good.
So you're saying people actually have to study, that they should understand how the creative assets they use are actually being used in the bigger picture, and how they perform really, right? Like what works, what doesn't work.
Right. How do we bring all these different things together? So you'll have to be more of an expert in an industry, and also have a broader toolkit that you bring to it. So it's not going to be enough to just do, say, marketing automation for something. You're going to have to weave a lot of different tactics to work together for clients. And that complexity is going to be won by the smarter firms who are the most deeply specialized, who have data-driven models and so on. But I'm not glass half full about that. I'm not half glass empty. I'm very much half glass full. I feel like the industry has a very bright future. And like as an example, like you could say right now that, wow, procurement's never had more influence and there's never been more competition eating at us from the bottom. And those things are true. But what's also true is that we've never had smarter firms than we do now at the mid and upper level. We've never had firms making as much money as they are now. We've never had firms who are as specialized as a percentage of the industry. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, I think this, the future for this industry is fantastic.
How do you, how do you see the, so there are many challenges for creative studios, obviously. And I like the idea that people have to kind of build their expertise. This is what you're saying. They have to specialize more, maybe not narrow it down, but actually get a deeper knowledge of and solve the complexity for the client. How, one of the most complex questions that I get asked from clients is like, how do we find clients? How do we get clients? Mm-hmm. Do you have like a magic silver bullet for that? What's the answer?
It's more a magic sequence of events rather than a single magic bullet. So I don't know how I could help a firm, and I've worked with more than 1,000 firms now intimately, and I don't know how you would build a marketing plan for a typical firm without a tight focus. So it's going to require specialization. Mm-hmm. Normally, it doesn't always have to require specialization, but essentially you've got to get famous. That's really what a marketing plan is. And how are you going to get famous unless you can narrow that down in an addressable market? If you don't have a tight positioning and you need to get famous, then you're going to need to get famous with a whole lot of people. That means you do some viral talk for TED or some other organization, South by Southwest or something, or maybe you write a book, or maybe you do some groundbreaking work that everybody has learned of, and that launches your career, right? But most of us don't have any of those three options in front of us. So you're going to have to narrow that down. That's the first step. Second is that you have got to begin articulating what you think. Like, here's why sales is hard. It's because marketing isn't happening. Like, and the difference between, so here's the difference. Like, if I talk with a prospect who heard about me just recently, they don't really know much, and they're thinking about working together, they ask me so many questions, and I'm sitting here thinking, wow, you really have no idea that I wrote 6 books, that I invented all kinds of things. I don't mean to be arrogant here. I'm just saying, or like, we have the biggest podcast in the space. Or contrast that with somebody mm-hmm. who calls me and they've been following what I do for years. They know all that stuff. They know how I think. They know my point of view on things. And all they want to know is this a fit? Should we work together? Should I hire David to help apply this specifically to my firm, right? So in that second scenario, sales is really easy because I've done a lot of marketing. So that's the second part of it. First part, Ooh. Be focused. Second, articulate what you think broadly with discipline. If nothing else, it's not just because it helps people know how you think. It's because you don't really know what you think until you start to articulate it, right? And then the third thing I would bring to it, I think there's 3 things. And that third thing is, you've got to believe in your abilities. You've got to have that sort of confidence. It can't be unfounded confidence, the kind of unfounded confidence that your mom had where you could do no wrong. No, it's really believing that, all right, this is what we charge. If we're not a good fit for you, Mr. Prospect, completely understand. Let me introduce you to somebody else that might be a better fit, and then move on. I'd rather starve than compromise that sort of confidence. Those are the 3 things that it's going to take. And a lot of firms are doing really good work that way. They're doing all 3 of those things and they're thriving. They're happy. They're running good businesses. The people like to work there. They make a lot of money. They're moving the needle. That's my perspective on it. I think that I have boundless enthusiasm for this industry. I would say probably 2/3 of the people in this industry don't get it, but I don't care. some of them will come around and some of them won't. That's fine.
Like what? Some people don't get what?
They don't get the idea that I'm going to need to be focused specialist. I'm going to need to have a marketing plan. I'm going to need to believe that I'm worth it. They just don't. They're the half glass empty. They're the people that we were talking about, right?
And those people actually, they move into the scarcity mindset once the client asks to lower the price, and they will agree to it. And
right.
Yeah.
And it's a self-affirming thing, right? And then they say, listen, clients don't value what we do. Like, well, yeah. And it just becomes this cycle that repeats itself.
Because they don't have any other options. They don't have any other people coming through the door. So they kind of, actually, the only option they have is to take on the job and lower the prices. And what you're saying is, if they would do marketing, if they would do sales, if they would actually position as an expert, they would have less or maybe none of those problems, and would also have the confidence to say no to a client. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, the client will actually be more likely to agree to your pricing.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I think you use the word options, and I really think that is the lever that needs to be pulled. Mm-hmm. Because we can be sitting here around a campfire with a drink in our hands and talk to ourselves about how valuable we are to the industry. But in the end, it takes a lot of courage to act that way when your two choices appear like this. One choice is, I've got people sitting around with nothing to do. And the other option is, take this client, which is not ideal, but at least it's something. It's not as profitable as I would like it to be, but at least it's something. And so what you said, you use the word options, and I really do think that's where it comes into play. So it takes too much courage to turn down this single opportunity you have to fill this gap. It takes no courage at all to choose between two options for the one slot you have. So you can choose the better client in that case. And so, yeah, I think options is really critical.
And what I also love what you just said is, the people don't know what they think, and that's why they need to articulate that and post about it, write about it, write a book, write content. You have written many books. When you started writing the book, did you know exactly what you're going to write about, or was that like a process? Like, did you discover your own thoughts and your expertise by writing those books?
In some cases, for sure. And I should say, yes, I've written 6 books. They're not all good. I'd say 3 of them are good. In one case, I had written many, many articles. And so the process of writing a particular article on this topic did help me figure out what I believed. And then I put the articles together. That was for the financial management book. But the others, I knew kind of the topic. Not 100%. I knew generally the topic, but that was about all I knew. And in fact, you know, when I started writing The Business of Expertise, I thought it was going to be this massive tome that would become almost like an academic, the textbook for the course, right? It was going to cover everything. And I was bored myself writing this thing. And I said, my God, if I'm bored, imagine how the readers are going to feel. So I really trashed the whole thing and began to write more of a passionate manifesto sort of a thing. What one of my good friends, Blair Enns, wrote the Win Without Pitching manifesto. And I've always been in love with that idea of a manifesto. I didn't call it manifesto, but that was a sense. It's like, listen, I'm dying on this hill, people. Come with me if you want. So back to your question. Yes. I don't know what I like. The process of writing is, you write and then you know what you believe. You don't figure everything out and then you write. It's like the clarity comes in the articulation, not before it. And I think that's true for everybody. I just have honestly admitted it.
Thank you for that. And it's so true. And I love, this is the biggest hurdle for creatives. When I talk to them about content creation, like, I don't know what to say. And what you just said is, what you just explained is, you don't have to know what you you don't have to know what you believe and what to write about, but you just need to get started and you will figure it out on the way. You will discover your beliefs, your thoughts, create content.
Yeah, right. And if I could add something to that, is that people are a lot smarter than they think they are, but they keep hearing themselves. They're a part of every conversation that's being had. The other side changes, a different person on the other side of the table every day, but they're always present for what they say. And so they kind of get used to it and they don't realize how much intelligence there is there. And so sometimes they need to have somebody else come along and watch them, because I'm pretty stupid, except when I'm like in an interview or on the phone with a client or speaking, like one of those three things. And so somebody needs to pay attention to the things I say that seem to move the audience. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's a thought that I could probably build into something else down the road. And like one time I said to somebody, it's like, the problem you have, you do this positioning for your clients all the time. That's not the problem. You're good at that. We know that because your clients love your work. But you're inside your own jar and you can't read the label on the outside from the inside, right? I just said that one time. Apparently it was a thought that had been moved around everywhere. I'd never seen it. And so that, like, it really resonated with the person hearing that for the first time. It's like, okay, I need to run with that image, right? And that's what happens with everybody. People are smarter than they think they are. They don't think they're as smart as they are because they keep hearing themselves talk all the time.
Yeah, that's a great point, because you get used to that, right? You say the same thing and it's like an old thing you said, and you assume everyone knows that, but yeah, the people change, the conversations change, some people don't know it yet. Mm-hmm. That's a great point. So people should get out, they should share their expertise, they should write about it. In the end, that's how they will first develop their expertise, and secondly, actually be seen as the expert, right? Like what you also said, like famous, like marketing is about getting famous. Mm-hmm. What would you tell people that have like something like an imposter syndrome or feeling ashamed to go out there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What, like, how can we move them?
Well, I don't think we want to remove all of the shame. For instance, I think, like, if we stay on this track of articulating what you think, some of that should always be accompanied by a little bit of fear that you're wrong. And so that fear can be hardest to make you dig deeper and to be a little bit more sure that you're right, even though you're not 100% sure. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there's the imposter syndrome, which is a different perspective. Like it's more of a disease than what I'm talking about, right? And I would say that everybody faces that. There's still times when I do as well. But, you know, at certain points in your career, you know, there's this combination of winging it and tasting very deep competence. And the difference between the two is so staggeringly different. It's like you finish a talk to maybe it's 20 people or maybe it's 2,000 people, doesn't matter. And you open it up for questions and you're pretty nervous. You hope somebody doesn't ask a question that you can't answer. That's the winging it sort of approach. The tasting competent sort of approach is like, bring it on. I'm sure I'm going to learn from a different perspective, but there's no question that somebody can throw at me that's going to knock me off of this. And so the imposter syndrome, the first way to solve that is to know what you're talking about. And the first way to solve that is to be more focused, because we live in a world that is so complex. There is no earthly way that you can be an expert in everything like you might have been able to be an expert in everything 30 years ago. So the world expects very different things from you. They expect you to have immediate answers at the lowest cost and the highest accuracy as possible. And there's no way as a human you can deliver on that promise unless you narrow your area of expertise. And so the first thing I would say to somebody suffering from imposter syndrome is, well, quit trying to be an expert in all those things. Just try to narrow it down a little bit. That'd be the first step.
That's amazing. So it's like narrowing down, like niching down, focusing is actually, that could very well be a solution to, or start to beat the imposter syndrome. When you, so I got to ask this. Because, and that's related to that, like this, not maybe not the imposter syndrome. I don't believe you have an imposter syndrome at all. But do you feel, what do you feel before you publish your books? Is there like an like a sense of maybe people don't like it?
It's a combination of relief that I've gotten past this hump and there's nothing else I can do. I've just released it to the world. And then there's a certain amount of terror where,
okay,
because your friends and your colleagues, they're going to pat you on the back and encourage you. And a lot, all of it's going to be sincere, but it's not all going to be correct. It's like what really happens is, and you've got to train yourself to not go read the Amazon reviews because they're on the less than 5-star reviews, there's a mix of people who made really genuine points. And you're thinking to yourself, you give yourself a dope slap and say, oh, shoot. Yeah, that's right. He's right. I should have fixed that. I should have thought about that differently. And then you have total idiots who just, they're often the glass half full, half empty people, excuse me. And so there is a mix of terror. But then at some point you just say, you know what? Screw it. It's like, at least I wrote a book. You know, true. I tried. I did my best. It might not be great. 3 of my books haven't been great, but at least I did it. And there's this sense of satisfaction that you put the effort in. You can't control how good it is at the end, how the people in the world receive it, but you can certainly put your heart and soul into it. And if they don't like it, that is painful, but it's part of the risk. It's like you, I think if we tie that question back, like how do you feel when you release a book, tie that back to how do you feel when you hit send on your weekly article? You should be a little nervous. It's like if you aren't a little bit nervous, then you're probably not taking many risks.
Oh, yes.
Right.
You're not out of your comfort zone. Right? You're just repeating things you know people have read before. That's great. So your weekly articles are actually amazing. And it's like, it's always something, like there's never something where I think I have heard this somewhere else. Mm. It's always a new, a fresh perspective. So how do you get to those insights? I mean, yes, you consult a lot of people, but it's like the topics you address are so out of the common questions people usually have. Mm-hmm. How do you get to those topics?
For me, and I think this is probably the way other people would work too, I'm not positive, but for me, I have to recognize the fact that these concepts that I want to write about, they're going to come to me at really weird, odd moments. And so I need to have a ubiquitous way to capture them, whether that's just jotting it down quickly on a post-it note while I'm on a conversation with a client, or maybe I'm in the car and I make a note to myself, right? So I just throw those into a big folder. And then my mind, the second thing that happens for me is that my mind is now looking for those. You know, like when you buy we bought an RV 3 years ago. And now when I'm driving down the highway, all I see is RVs. And I never noticed them before, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing with this. So once I say, oh, this might be a concept that I could kind of dress up and figure out. Ooh. Then I start to notice that everywhere. I see those. So let me throw that in this folder. And then I'll sit down. The third stage for me is I'll sit down on a weekend. I try to release them just after midnight, Sunday night. And I'll say, okay, what am I passionate about? I've got 140 ideas here. Which one am I passionate about right now? And I'll write it, right? So it's just a groove I've gotten into that might be helpful for people to hear, but I love it. I mean, to me, it's almost like an addiction. If I miss too many weeks, I start to get itchy where I just have to, like, okay, I gotta get back on track. I miss this. I want to do it.
So you write them out of an emotional state. You said it's when you what you feel passionate about, right? So you have like an emotional trigger. You want to get something out. You want there's a question, there's an answer you want to give to the people. Mm-hmm. How long does it take you to write such an email, such a newsletter?
So the average newsletter is about, I think, 1,200 words would be my guess. I don't aim for anything. I just write what I need to say and then I shut up. But about 1,200 words, and that takes me about 2 hours start to finish. I've already got the stuff thrown into a folder, so I just read it again, and then it takes about 2 hours to write it.
So you do editing, you actually write and rewrite, things like that, right? Correct?
Yes. Not enough. Okay. My stuff could be more heavily edited, but I start to lose interest in it when I do too much of that. So I just say, heck, it's good enough. Here it goes. Yeah. I'm not going to overthink it.
Something I didn't address early on, what you said, you gave an answer to publishing the book and you said like anything below 5 stars, they might have some valid points about what you could have addressed, what you could have done differently, something maybe you missed something. How do you deal with that?
I try not to read them because I don't deal with it well. It's just like if you monitor who unsubscribes from your email list, it's devastating. Like I do not want to know who unsubscribes. Yeah, I can't handle that. I'm a little too fragile emotionally that way.
That's a good point. Okay, so just not going to look anymore. Mm-hmm. Coming back to the scarcity mindset, so we talked about people need to position, focus, basically. They should do marketing. And the third one was they also should
be confident.
Be confident. What are some practical things people can start doing today? Maybe you want to give them a challenge that they can perform to actually get that half full glass. Mm-hmm.
I think it probably is best to start with forcing yourself to articulate thoughts that aren't completely fully formed yet. And that's where I would start. Mm-hmm. And instead of trying to, I guess, fulfill an assignment that somebody gave you, try to write something and say to yourself, listen, when this hits the world, I want people to unsubscribe or forward it to somebody else. I'm willing to take that risk that when they read this, it's going to force one of two things. They're either going to unsubscribe or they're going to think it's so good they forward it to somebody that a friend of theirs or something. And so start to take more risks. What people will find is that, wow, it wasn't that much of a risk anyway. It's like now all of a sudden they're more interested in what you're writing because you're being more human, you're being more thoughtful, you're saying the quiet things out loud. The other thing I would say, and I'll have to tell you in advance that I don't know if this next thing is good advice, but I quit trying to understand people deeply.
Okay.
I just assume that we're all the same. It's like, if I struggle with this, other people do too. And it's a little bit like a cheat, I guess, and it may not be good advice, but I just think we're humans writing to humans. Let's just assume we're all the same and quit looking for all the ways that I can personalize this message and all that nonsense. It's just like, no, this is just, let's make it simple.
So you stop thinking about what other people think because you assume that other people kind of are similar, at least in the niche we are.
Right.
And does that prevent you from overthinking?
It probably helps, right? It could be just self-protective, or maybe it's just lazy where I don't want to dive that deep. But I've kind of decided it's like, you know what? This is me. I'm giving you me. You're like me. Let's just try to figure this out together. I'm not going to have 17 different personas and write shaped to each one of those. It's like, no, there's one persona. It's human. And yeah. Like I said, that's probably not good advice, but that's what I do.
Do you think that overthinking and the scarcity mindset in some way related?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because overthinking is usually just simply, it's really an excuse to not act dressed up in really noble language. Overthinking is, you know, I don't know what the percentage is here, but right in the first few hours of a concept, you're getting 90% of it. The next 20 hours you spend are only getting you 5% further. Like, I'm just making those numbers up. I don't know what's real there, but it's, overthinking is an excuse not to act in many, many, many cases. Now, some people are more prone to that because of their personalities. Mm-hmm. They just need to be self-aware. And then some people are prone to underthinking for sure. So you have to be self-aware about that. But I'm trying to help people not overthink, because I think it kind of just kills the impact they could have because they're so worried about not getting it right.
So what do you do with your clients when they, I mean, positioning is kind of, I mean, if people overthink then with their positioning, right? So what do you do when you feel or when you see they get stuck in overthinking with their positioning or their offering and things like that?
Yeah. I heard my podcast co-host say something one time that really stuck with me, and I've borrowed it. Blair said, you don't need a perfect positioning. You need a perfectible positioning. So the difference between the two is not observable until you get out in the wild. So you come up with a close enough positioning, and then you start listening to signals that tell you where you need to adjust it, but you're never going to get those signals until you put it out there in the wild. And so I try to, that helps people, keeps them from overthinking, because we don't have to have the perfect one. We just need a perfectible one, one that's close enough.
I like that term. I need to ask if I can borrow that. This is
amazing. You'll have to ask Blair. You have to ask Blair, yes. Not me. Yeah.
I ask Blair. And what it does is really, like, it takes off the pressure, right? This doesn't have to be perfect. It just needs to, we need some data. Put it out there and we'll see if people like it or not, and what happens.
Yeah.
This is amazing. David, I want to be respectful of your time. I know you have a call coming up at the top of the hour, but if I may ask you one last question.
Sure.
What, like, do you have a message for the audience?
Well, yeah, quit annoying me with your scarcity mindset. That would be the first message. When we get on the phone with you the first time, like, don't act totally defeated. I can't really help you. Act like a lot of things are going well. There's just something that just isn't quite right and you need some help. It's like, things are not as bad as you think. They're also not as good as you think. So just try to arrive at a correct assessment of how things are going at your firm and your, and just take control. I guess, yeah, that's the final message, is agency, to use another economics term. Use the agency you have. Like, you started your firm because you got tired of the boss you were working for, or you felt like you didn't have enough control over your clients, or you weren't making enough money, and so on. You left the firm and started your own because you wanted to have a different firm. So here you have a different firm. Keep aiming for the kind of firm that you want. It's, don't just accept it like the firm you left. Like, this is, no, this is your thing. Oh. Like, the options, the possibilities are amazing. Just start, just don't worry about being right on everything. Just start making changes. Start creating things in your own image, like your firm, so that it's a representation of what you believe and what you want. And quit thinking that everybody's against you. They aren't.
And so basically, remind yourself why you started this whole journey. You wanted to be different, do things better. So don't accept the standard you are at and set a higher standard. I love that. That's a great message. And that's a very needed message for a lot of people out there. David, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this talk. I hope we can do this again at some point.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Yeah, I really appreciate it. It was a great conversation, great questions. Very nice to do this with you.
thanks. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Mark Pfann and hope to see you all again on our next show where we unfold creative business.